Welcome to the Value Cultures podcast. Today, Value Cultures co-founder Daryl Ogden speaks with game industry vet Mitch Gittleman. Mitch launched his gaming career in Chicago before becoming a founding member of Microsoft Game Studios. He spent several years at Microsoft and specifically at Xbox, and then later founded Harebrained Schemes with Jordan Weissman, who, as you'll hear, Mitch invokes in this conversation to offer some wise words. At Harebrained, Mitch released a number of games, including Strike Fleet Omega, Shadowrun Returns, Shadowrun Dragonfall, Battletech, and most recently, The Lamplighters League, which another recent guest of ours, Jen O'Neill of Magic Soup Games, cited as a favorite game that she's been playing recently. In the interview, Daryl asks Mitch to sketch his career, and he notably discusses ways that his theater education and background, as well as improvisational training, have shaped his approach to making games and even scaling a studio. If you enjoy this conversation, please follow the podcast, and you can learn more about valued cultures and even download our recent report, Winning Game Studio Culture in the Post-Pandemic Era, at valuedcultures.com. That's one word, valued cultures. And now, Mitch Gittleman speaks with Daryl Ogden.
So Mitch, it's so great to be with you again today. And I think it's worthwhile saying that this big research project that we've kicked off at Value Cultures back in 2023, you were one of the very first people that we interviewed for that work. And so in a way, this feels like it's a full circle conversation because subsequently we talked to probably another 100 leaders or so in the industry, but you helped shape in a way the outline of that work and were quite constitutive in that way. So it's really wonderful to be back with you today.
Oh, that's fantastic. It's an honor that I could be part of the early forming of your work. That's incredibly cool to hear. Thank you.
As a result, you're one of the first podcast guests as well, as we have kicked off this new podcast series. And a big focus for us, of course, is to pick up on many of the themes and some of what we think of as the key takeaways from our report, Winning Game Studio Culture in the Post-Pandemic Era. And I think that what we're imagining is having a conversation today that in part will take aspects of you and your long career in the game industry and what you saw as particularly perhaps relevant for your experience, especially in terms of building culture and cultivating culture in the different game organizations and game studios that you've led over the years. And so we're really excited about that conversation.
That's awesome. I'm happy to be a part of it.
But before we do that, one of the things that we love to do is to hear the stories of the game leaders that we've gotten to know in this process. And from your many decades in the industry, there are so many different stories that make up the full constellation of what it might mean to be a game leader. So I wonder if you could tell us yours. How did this strange and wonderful career come about for you?
Well, it was strange and wonderful. It was both very, very intentional and wildly accidental. To start with, when I thought about getting into games, I was actually working for Blockbuster Video. Actually, I loved it there. I spent 7 years at Blockbuster Video, and this is no joke or exaggeration. I started as the day shift guy cleaning the shelves at Blockbuster Video and checking out the five customers at 10 in the morning that you would get or something. And I worked myself up to being in charge of training for the Midwest, right?
Right.
Which only in retail. It's glory to retail. It was my graduate school in a lot of ways. So I was traveling the country as a management trainer, a stand-up management trainer, teaching the basics of management and hiring skills, et cetera, to people. And because I was traveling around the country, I had so much time to myself where I was just completely alone with nothing to do. And so I started writing paper and pencil role-playing game books like Dungeons and Dragons for a friend of mine who actually was in charge of R&D for a company. And at some point in there, as I'm in another hotel room, completely filled with cigar smoke, typing away at my next adventure or whatever, he said, the video game industry could really use people like us. I'm like, what the hell does that mean? It's like, you know, people that think about story and character and setting. Because again, this was 1993, and it was still really early days. So what we did was we went to the Consumer Electronics Show in Chicago. We paid our way in, but really what we were there for was the guidebook. And again, this is before the internet, and this is before the World Wide Web and stuff. So that guidebook was critical to us. And what we did was we got to be names of 70 game companies, and we made a trifold brochure because we were into desktop publishing. We were paper and pencil game guys. And we made a trifold brochure, sent it out to 70 companies and said, look at what we can do for you. We can add such value as designers, storytellers, et cetera. And we actually got a 10% return. Seven companies said they would talk to us. It was shocking. Just this mass mailing. That's all. It was just cold calling. What happened was one of the companies said, we'd like to meet you at the Winter Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas. So we flew out there, met with these seven companies. One of them was Sony Interactive Europe. And they had an idea for a game, but it wasn't going well. And it was a 3D game. And it was going to be for this new secret. We had to sign NDAs up the yin yang. It was amazing because it was for the PlayStation launch.
Wow.
That's how we did it. It was just, what's the word? Complete bullshit, really, is what it was. It was just sales. I mean, we had ideas about games and stuff and had done paper and pencil games, but I knew nothing at all about how games were made. Or anything. It was just bravado. I don't know.
I love the BS theory of game development, of kicking off a career, you know, but so many careers are built on chutzpah, on a bravado in a sense. And people start that way. If there's no substance, the career generally doesn't continue.
Eventually, what happened was we flew out to Wales and we were staying with the head of the studio in his home, which was like a hobbit hole. Literally, his house was built into the side of a hill. So there are only windows in the front. It's just like Hobbiton and the Shire and Bag End. Me and my partner are out there. We're taking a walk with him and his giant Irish wolfhound. And we're across the lane. There's no real streets there. In a goat pasture. And we're all standing in goat shit. And he says, so, how much? We're like, how much what? Like, how much for you to quit your day jobs and do this full time, make video games with us full time, freelance, external. And we had come up with a number in our heads, you know, fantasy number on the flight over there. But it actually happened. I quoted him double that price, because why not? And
right.
My partner was shaking, and he's 6'6". So he's just trembling, like, oh my God, what are you doing? And the producer, the studio manager, he says, well, that's more than I make. And I said, yeah, well, we're the talent. And he, right then and there, stuck out his hand. He says, done. I shook it. And I said to him, could I please talk to my partner alone for a minute? So he squishes off and he goes back into his house. And my friend turns to me, he's like, what did you do? And I said, well, I think we're in the game business now. We're actually making pretty good money. I said, but, and then I started to tremble. I said, I have a question for you. What's a pixel?
And here we are 31 years later.
And I still don't really know.
It's a wonderful story. And one of the aspects of your career that I remember so well from our initial conversations is that you have a background in theater. And it's interesting, you're not the first successful game developer I've met who has that specific background. And maybe that relates to the kind of storytelling that you captured so beautifully and eloquently in your trifold brochure. But I wonder if you could speak to how theater has informed your career as a game developer.
I treasure my time in theater. I treasure my education in theater. It taught me a ton of stuff about preparation, you know, et cetera. There's a lot to it. But at its core, I think theater really is about a group of very disparate people with very different skills and talents, all coming together for a common goal, which is to entertain an audience and creating something that resonates with an audience that they'll talk about when they leave. That's the core of theater, right? That's the core of video games. There's really no difference. And I was an acting and a directing student. What I learned there as a directing student is about all the departments that need to come together, you know, costuming, lighting, set design, audio, huge part of it, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm sure I'm leading things out. No disrespect to my friends still working at theater. But learning how to communicate with very different people with different skill sets and having them align on a common vision, you could see the one-to-one there. It's obvious.
In some ways, it's the best possible training you could have as a game studio director.
I couldn't say. All I knew is that was mine. The other thing that's so interesting about it, just to wax poetic for a minute, one of the big lessons that I learned in theater that was reinforced to me by one of my former partners, Jordan Weissman, the creator of Shower on Battletech, Hero Quest, people, he's a legend. He says, the audience can tell when the people making it had a smile on their face, right? In theater, it's so obvious when the cast isn't clicking and when the crew isn't clicking, you just get the sense that something's off about this production.
Creativity and joy in some ways are conjoined, aren't they?
Absolutely.
At least the best creativity, I think.
Well, I think people combining their talents is a huge thing. One of the things I used to talk about all the time with harebrained schemes is alchemy. Mm. You know, I just listened to Jen O'Neill's podcast from Magic Soup. Lovely. I can't wait to meet her someday because we share many of the same philosophies. And she called it Magic Soup for a reason, which I totally agree with, because what we are fundamentally doing when done well is a form of alchemy. It's all of these ingredients being put together and all of these people with their skills and talents all coming together. And the combination is greater than the sum of the parts.
And a transformation happens, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. And the transformation happens on the team, both in theater and in video games. There's always that moment where it's not coming together. People still don't know their lines, whatever it is. It's just not happening. And then you have that one rehearsal where suddenly you realize, oh, we've got something. And there's always that one moment when you're building a prototype or you're creating a demo where you realize, oh, crap, this is actually a thing. And the team starts to feel it and the momentum starts to build. I love that.
I think that there's something that we've discussed before as well about a particular kind of theater or a particular kind of performance that has been particularly important to you, I think, and that is the notion of improvisation and improvisational theater. And I wonder if you could speak to that.
One of the most influential people in my life was a man named Sheldon Patinkin. And he was one of the creators of Second City in Chicago. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of it. It's a nightclub.
Of course.
And that's where improvisational theater, in many ways, at least in America, was born. Sheldon was very instrumental to me, a lot of his philosophies. And I worked there for a while in the early 80s, and it really had a profound impact on me. There's a book written about it called Something Wonderful Right Away. There's something so interesting about it, because it's a matter of being very, very present, thinking on your feet, yes, and always taking somebody's idea and instead of knocking it down, adding to it and attempting to make it into something bigger and more relevant. That yes, and or plusing ideas is a big part of improvisation.
It's been memorialized on your arm.
Yeah, you're right. It is written on my arm. It says improvise, adapt, overcome, which is the nature of entrepreneurship for me. It's that idea that, as my partner Jordan used to say, entrepreneurship is the idea of jumping off a cliff and believing that you'll be able to fashion a set of wings before you hit the ground. It's that sense of, I'm going to walk out on stage without having any idea really what's going to happen. I have a scenario in my head, but I have to be in the moment and I have to move with it and just flow, like Bruce Lee said, like water around rocks. Whatever happens, you will find a way to counteract that or find a way past or through it.
I love that. Just thinking about all the different game development scenarios that you have lived through and led, and the scenarios that I have seen from the other side in terms of helping game studios and leaders sort out problems and challenges and so on. If you don't have a dose of improvisation in you, things can get hard and frustrating pretty quickly because you do have to, as you say, adapt and overcome. So that motto that's emblazoned on your arm, I think it's perfect for the industry. Mitch, what I'd love to do is I'd love to turn to some of your reflections on ideas that are report stimulated. We've had subsequent conversations since we published the report. One of the elements of the report that seems to have really drawn your interest, because it has been such an important part of your career, is this notion of moving a startup game studio to something that you're actually scaling into something bigger. And what that means by way of challenge and opportunity for preserving and or amplifying your culture in some ways and being very intentional about what scaling means for your culture. And so I would love for you to kick us off in a way, thinking about the report today, about that idea about scaling culture and how you have gone about that in your career and what you've learned about that.
I really enjoyed reading the report and what a lot of people like me and like Jen O'Neill at Magic Soup are going to go through are scaling challenges. When you have a small, intimate team, intimate studio, it's very easy to reinforce culture, even remotely, I think. The trick is scaling it. And the thing that I've learned about scaling, having done it a few times, is first of all, it is possible. Now, I've never done it, just full disclosure, to the thousands of people. Games now are made by multiple studios and multiple places. I've never done that. I have definitely scaled to triple digits. I think the way that I go about it is actually part from a lesson that I learned in retail, which is it's a classic lesson in retail, which is a job that is inspect is respect, right? Mm-hmm. And we talk about intentionality in creating culture, and that's part of it. The leaders of the studio have to pay attention to it. If you want the shelves of your store clean, walk around every day and say, hey, these aren't clean enough, and people will start paying attention to that. It's just logic, mm-hmm. right? It's just human nature. And so when you pay attention to how people interact with each other, how we do our work, how we come together to achieve goals together, that's how you transmit culture. That's how leaders transmit cultures. One of the things that I believe is very important that you have to do is, I don't want to use the word policing. That's not the right term. But when you see something that is culturally off target, right? Mm-hmm. Speaking up, timely, direct feedback is one of the key things for any manager and any leader. And I've done it in meetings while it's going on. It's like, hey, wait a minute, the way we're addressing this problem, I feel is unhealthy. Let's step back for a moment. Going forward, what I want to see from you, and I would say things just like that. In our next meeting, if something like this comes up again, this is the way I want it handled.
Yes.
And there's a real power in that. You know, leaders just learning to use their voice and saying, this is what I want, is such a key part of this entire thing. So that's the basics of it. A job right. that's expected is respected. From there, what I've done for scaling is really focus on the end-to-end hiring practices in your studio. And I mean extreme ends. I think Jen said it during her podcast, her website was part of that. What's written on there was very, very intentional.
And yes,
I completely agree with that. Coming from retail and coming from sort of a customer experience point of view, the people joining your studio and the people talking to them, the people talking to them are like ambassadors of your studio and ambassadors of the culture. So the recruiter, for example, at my own studio, Harebrained Schemes, her written communication was always very thoughtful and friendly and really reflected the candidate that she was talking to so that people yes. don't feel like pieces of meat. And especially in the environment that we're in right now with so many studio closures and layoffs, et cetera, I think people are starting to feel very much like commodities.
Yes.
So starting off that way, I think is really important.
There's something I think about that from the moment of first contact that anybody has with your organization, and in your case, a game studio, that first contact is a cultural contact.
It is.
And it runs all the way through. I think that where many organizations get in trouble is that either their recruiting and hiring practices are so good and so thoughtful and so intentional that the candidate gets excited about the job, and then the other side discovers that the actual job is not very intentional and not nearly as good as the hiring practice, or vice versa. Either one of those disconnects, I think, is relevant. And so in a way, the hiring process, the recruiting process needs to be a kind of a, almost like a simulation of what it's going to be in that organization. Was that true for you?
It's absolutely true for me. From first contact through a phone screen and through an interview loop, you're setting up a resonance, a harmonic resonance within the other person, within the candidate. And
yeah.
the way they feel about how they were treated during that hiring process, the respect they were given, the camaraderie they were shown. Things that I don't like is this sort of, we've got this club and we're the gatekeepers of this club and we're the cool kids and we're either going to let you in or not, and you've got to prove yourself to us. I'm not a big fan of that. It's more of a welcoming process and getting them a real sense of what it's like to work with the team during the interview process so that they understand what they're getting themselves into and that there is no buyer's remorse or seller's remorse. Let's just say no remorse.
Let's make it remorseless. No right. remorse. That's right.
Remorseless. Yes. I like that's my new studio, Remorseless Studios. One of the things as a leader that I believe is critical is creating a hiring practice, a hiring process that is truly intentional as well. You want to choose people on the hiring team to be the interviewers that represent your company, that represent the values of your company well and transmit them well and can identify them in others. That's critical. And not just subject matter experts. What I've always done is starting with subject matter experts right off the bat, after some rapport building and things like that, then you get them in with the people they'll actually be working with. I like to have them solve problems together to see what'll happen. That's really interesting.
That's a form of improvisational theater in a way, isn't it?
It really is. And it just gives you an idea how they think. Especially for senior leaders, I've done this. For some very senior leaders, I brought them into my management team meeting. And this is one where I was trying to hire a COO. So I brought the candidate in. I said, you'll run our weekly meetings. Here's my agenda for the weekly meeting. Run it.
Right.
And we just did it together. And it was not a practice session. We were attempting to solve real world problems. And everybody was behaving just like that. It's like, is this the right fit for you? Now, that's an extreme case.
Yes.
But for a very specific role, you see that. But back to the hiring team, it's very important from my perspective that you set up a series of interviews on very specific topics. I start always with the technical and the skill building stuff, because if they don't have the skills or the potential to demonstrate the skills we want, what's the rest of it mean? It doesn't matter. So we get that out of the way as soon as possible. Yes, this person has what we need. Now the question is, can we work together well? You know,
right.
What is it like? And I think a lot of people, I was just talking to the CEO of a game company recently that was not being intentional with their hiring. And this is AAA we're talking about. There's a lot of money on the line. And the CEO was saying that they were having trouble with the senior leader in the studio. And it turns out they hadn't had the upfront conversations they needed to have. And here they are now, months down the line. It's like, whoops.
Wow.
At their brain schemes, one of the things we did is we had an interview, a 1-hour interview that was called Respect and Collaboration. This is the Respect and Collaboration interview. I always have the same set of people do it for consistency reasons. It wasn't the same three people. I mean, we had like fives that you could use as a pool to pull from. They had set questions they asked every candidate to keep it fair, keep it equitable, and to remove as much bias as we could from it. But we actually then asked them questions. But, you know, like, tell me about a time when you disagreed with one of your coworkers and what happened, right? It was classic interviewing, behavioral interviewing. Tell me a story. This is critical to build your culture and to maintain and scale your culture. Have people tell you stories, because it's not hypothetical BS. Back to the BS things again. It's like, oh, you know, because they can build anything airy-fairy. The trick is to tell them something that actually happened. Tell me a story about a conflict you had or a disagreement you had and what happened. And then you dive into the specifics and you find out how they behave in real-world situations. And then you get to see, that's going to be reproduced at our studio.
Right. For better and worse.
Right.
So one of the stimuli for us to pick up on this element of the rapport is that, in a way, this is a nice complement to the conversation with Jen. Jen, at the beginning, startup, you know, a startup culture that she and her colleagues are trying to establish at Magic Soup. You're talking about how to scale something that exists. And so there's always this challenge, I think, for any leader. And we like to talk about this as like the game studio lifecycle. And the classic scaling might be that you're working on more than one game at a time, or you cross a certain threshold in terms of the number of people in your studio. But one of the things that stimulated this conversation for us, Mitch, is there's something that's very powerful about starting something up where everybody joins in with the same vision, the same notions of what the culture should be. And it's a core of people who all were attracted to the same things. And it's hard to find those people initially, I think, that you are attracted to like that and feel so strongly about a set of things. But it, in a way, it's harder to add new people to that group who will hold those ideas constant in a way. And so when you thought about what scale meant, what did it mean, like from a numbers perspective or from like a behavior perspective in the studio, meaning now we're doing two games at once or now we're over 25 people? What were the thresholds for you, the triggers where you said, we have to be even more intentional now in a way?
Yeah, unfortunately, it comes from negative experience usually.
Yeah.
What a shock.
Yes.
Experience is what you get right after you've screwed up.
Just that. For free, right? Yeah.
People rarely grow based on positive experience. In my lifetime, I haven't seen it. It's always after they've messed up that you really get the growth. That's what happened to me. We've scaled and scaled back multiple times over the 13 years that Harebrained Schemes existed. We scaled up and scaled back for the same reasons. Aspirationally, wanted to do more things, giving more opportunity to our leaders to step up, lead their own project, et cetera, all the positive things. And going to more than one project in a studio is one of the most crucial decisions you're going to make, right? Do we actually have the talent that we need to actually do two projects or yes. more? And one of the things Don Mantrick, who was the president of Xbox Games for a while, says, the rule of whole numbers, I love this. The rule of whole numbers is, do we have a complete leadership team? Do we have two complete leadership teams? Yes or no? No. Okay. So we have to fill certain key leadership roles. How many? If we have to fill multiple leadership roles externally, that is a big risk to your culture, because the more senior someone is, the more baggage they bring, the more experience they bring.
Yes. And the more views of culture they bring, their own experiences, right?
And the more chances you have of them, I mean, they're going to be highly, highly influential.
Yes.
Highly influential. And that's how your culture can start to slip. And that's exactly what happened to me.
That happened to you? What happened?
We very much wanted to give our senior leaders an opportunity. You know, up until that point, my partner and I had conceived of and led every project. And we wanted our up-and-coming senior leaders, who are very, very talented, to do that. We had to hire externally for some of the roles. Then we were also separated, unfortunately, by two different floors in the same building. So we couldn't even see how the other team was being run. On top of that, we didn't put together infrastructure so that we could see what they were doing. We were so busy running our project, we couldn't necessarily oversee their project. Classic.
Yes.
So that's a big scaling issue when it comes to leadership. Do you have whole numbers there? And who do you have to bring in? And do they actually share your values? And what I discovered was, no, there was a major drift happening. Part of it was about respect. Like one of the core tenets of the studio. And this is actually when I started to quantify and become more intentional in culture, was the leaders of this other project were draining the joy from game development because they were the smartest guys in the room and nobody could make a suggestion that they'd ever listened to. And one of them actually said to me, why do I have to listen to this junior guy? Why do I care what this junior guy has to say? I'm like, well, he's a member of your demographic, your audience. He plays these games religiously. He might have something to say about it, that kind of thing. And so the culture drifted pretty hard. And I had to bring it back in hard.
There's something here that's so powerful, Mitch, I think, which is there's a siren call in a way for talent, for experience, for people in the industry, people who've previously made great games before. And if you can acquire that talent, it's obviously an enormous asset.
Yeah.
But if there is a cultural misfit with that talent, you can't even come close to realizing the return on investment on that talent because of the kind of misalignment that you're describing. And it leads to what you called, in your case, you called it drift. Some people might call it decline, deterioration, et cetera. It probably was only drift in your case because you grabbed hold of it and you reined it back in. If it had continued to drift, I think deterioration and decline would follow.
Oh, right? There's no question about it, Daryl. Yeah. It was happening. The postmortem or the retrospective for that particular project was ugly and people were drained. It was very hard. And I had to use that opportunity to start the healing process, right?
Yes. Just to round this out a little bit, you talked earlier about this power of joy in creativity, and joy and creativity go together. They are energizing. And so if you see a team that's completely depleted, crunch aside, because of course crunch happens and has happened for decades in the industry, but crunch aside, if there has been joy in that process, they shouldn't be that depleted at the end. They might be tired, but depleted is different from tired.
Very, very, very much. And like you said, yes, I was able to rein it back in, but it comes back to one of the most basic elements of leadership, which is use your voice. I have talked to studio leaders and senior leaders that feel like something is happening to them, right? My studio is deteriorating. Everything's happening. And somehow, like, it's out of their control. And so, well, the answer is always action. It's always action. What action are you taking? You know, somebody said that to me once a long time ago. Hey, it's your studio, man. You know, it's your studio. What do you want?
Yes.
Like, all right, yes. This is what I want. And to be upfront and articulate about it. But there's more to it. But again, going back to the end-to-end hiring process.
Yeah.
It comes back to, again, using that voice, exercising that. I was always the last interviewer. Nobody got in my studio without meeting with me and allowing me to assess them, because game development or creative projects, it's all about human algebra. Am I putting the right people together? And will I get the sum of the parts greater? And so one of the things that I would always ask people during that final interview was to compare the cultures of the last two places they worked. And that tells you so much. How they feel about management, how they feel about the touchy-feely processes or the hard process or whatever. By them comparing them, you get a sense of, oh, this is how they're going to feel about ours.
Right.
They can drill into that. So that was a very big part of it. And finally, of course, I would always ask them as my final question, knowing the sort of place we're trying to build and the type of people we're trying to attract here. We don't know through an interview loop. Let's just say it's 5-7 hours of interviews or even a couple of days. That's not enough time to really assess. I've been interviewing people since I'm 22. I'm not 22 anymore. And I can tell you, having been interviewing people all this time, you're always going to be surprised. And so the final question I would always say is, you know, what's something that we're going to learn about you in 3 months that you can just proactively tell us about yourself now?
Yeah.
And if they're the type of person that buy in to what you're trying to do, they'll tell you, you know.
What is embedded in that question essentially is, how self-aware are you, right?
Well done. Yes.
How well do you know yourself?
Yeah.
And how much of yourself are you willing to share with us?
Bravo. Right? When we would talk after, we would have a post-interview meeting where everybody would go around and talk about each individual person independently. We'd talk about the strengths, the areas of concern that they have for each candidate. We would talk about exactly that. Self-awareness is something you really need to look for in a candidate. Do they get it? Do they understand how they're coming off and what makes themselves tick? Because if they're walking blindly through their lives, that may be a flag for you.
Mitch, it's funny because we are conducting this interview today on the day that we published the Jen O'Neill interview. And one of the things that we asked Jen, and we ask all of the leaders that we interview, we ask, what's the last good game that you played? The last game that you really enjoyed? And without any prompting, we did nothing to prep Jen for this in any way, shape, or form. She mentioned Harebrained Schemes Lamplighters League, which is your last game. We were stunned in a way because there are lots of games to choose from. And I feel like Jen has been like a kind of a companion to us in this whole conversation today. But yeah. I want to turn that question to you. You have such a vast knowledge of games. You've been exposed to so many games. You've created so many games. But I wonder if there's a game that you've played recently that you'd want to share with the audience.
I would be happy to. I could wax poetic about this game. It's a little embarrassing. The problem is that it's like the darling of the game world right now. It's Baldur's Gate 3.
Oh, yeah.
I have put more time into Baldur's Gate 3 than any game ever that I didn't make and had to play. And that's nuts. And what Baldur's Gate 3 is for me, wow, it's crazy. This comes full circle. Remember, I was talking to that guy in the role-playing game industry that he said, hey, let's get into video games. They need people like this.
Yes.
That's the game we always wanted to make. Baldur's Gate 3 is the game I got into video games to make. And just for reasons, never had the chance to do it exactly. I've done some role-playing games that I'm proud of. Never the scope and the scale and the boldness of Baldur's Gate 3. It is stunning. I played through Act 2 of that game twice now. Fundamentally different experiences, dramatically different experiences. It's shocking how good that game is. I'm just glad it exists because it
yes,
but it can.
Yes. Someone different from you might be gnashing their teeth saying, that's the game that I always wished that I had made. But instead, you're operating with enormous generosity, which is one of your hallmarks as a person, giving that game team and that studio great credit for the masterpiece that they created.
They gave me a gift. You could see, again, like I said, the audience can tell when the people making the game were smiling.
Yes.
There are moments that I see in that game where I just think of the people making it and how they were giggling making that moment of the game. There are characters in that game that I wish I had written and voice directed myself. And I just love that. Batman Arkham Asylum is also that. It's an older game, but that's a game I wish I had made. That's one of the best role-playing games ever made. You're role-playing Batman, and you're Batman in that. Just kudos to that team as well. Brilliant work.
Mitch, I always enjoy our conversations so much. They're filled with wisdom and experience and humility and curiosity, which I think are all true of you as a person. We at Value Cultures are so grateful to you for all the contributions you've made to us already. And again, helping to really, in a way, set the direction in many cases for the research work that we did in the last year. We'll always be grateful to you for that and for the continued conversations.
I'm absolutely delighted to have been a part of it and to stay a part of it. And I think this is critical for the industry going forward. Something must change in this industry, and this is part of it.
Thanks, Mitch. We'll see you soon.
Cheers.